morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Wendy Kiefover-Ring from CNAPU about the poisoning of animals in the wild, and we're going to be speaking to Kenneth Knight from the Zia Singers and the Men's Camerata. Right now, I would like to welcome Jamie Porter Lara. She's with Community Action New Mexico. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you here, except that we are talking about a rather painful and difficult issue, and that is the provision of power to people who can't afford to pay their utility bills. This is a real problem that we face in New Mexico. What are the rules and the laws about the provision of power in the winter months to people who are disabled and to people who have low incomes?
As you said, this is a really serious issue, especially in the winter months. In 2005, New Mexico became the 40th state in the nation to provide some kind of seasonal protection to people who may not be able to afford their bills during the winter time. We call it the winter shutoff moratorium, and it says that between November 15th and March 15th, or during the heating season, that customers with low incomes cannot be disconnected from utility service for non-payment of their bills or if they happen to fall behind on their bills.
And so what does that mean? They fall behind on their bills. Do they have to make it up, make payment plans? What happens when they just can't afford their high bills?
There's nothing about this law that gets customers off the hook for their bills. Ultimately, they are responsible for them. It just says that if they can't keep up with them during the winter months, they can't be disconnected because that would be a serious risk to health and safety.
Now, there's a terrible story of a 69-year-old woman who was found dead in her unheated home and because the power company had cut off her heat in the winter.
Yes, that's being investigated right now. It's a terrible story. A woman in El Vado was found dead after her power had been disconnected. And there is some indication that she had no information from the electric co-op from which she received her power that she was eligible not to be disconnected during the winter time. And there also is an indication that this co-op made no effort to find out if this woman should have been protected under the law before disconnecting her power.
So, where does the responsibility lie? In other words, people who are low income, people who are disabled, can't get their power cut off. Other people, you and I, we can get our power cut off. Does the responsibility lie with the customer to tell the utility company their status? Does the utility company have the responsibility to find that out?
Well, you're talking about an issue that is actually there has been considerable confusion about this. This is a relatively new law, but we do have administrative regulations or laws in the state that essentially say that it's the responsibility of utilities to provide information to customers about their rights. And so when this new law was passed, it became the responsibility of utilities to inform customers that they had a right to not to be disconnected from utility service in the winter should they fall behind and should they meet certain financial requirements, should they have incomes that were sufficiently low.
So how is information being disseminated? And I've heard that some incorrect information is being disseminated.
Well, this is part of the problem. It has been our concern that, number one, customers are not being informed by utilities across the state of their rights under this law. And so one way that information could be disseminated, for example, is through information that's put into a bill. Usually utilities call them bill stuffers, something that you receive along with it. Another way of informing a customer is to include information on a disconnect notice or the notice that is put on a customer's door before disconnection can occur. That's something that's actually required by the law, that there be that type of contact. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is that in lots of circumstances around the state, utilities and co-ops have made no adjustments whatsoever to those forms of notice that would allow customers to understand what their rights are.
And so how are people reacting? We've had some very, very bitter cold days in Santa Fe, in New Mexico. Are you getting calls from people about this issue?
As a matter of fact, we do get calls on a day-to-day basis from people who are needing intervention on their behalf in order to avoid disconnection of service. We have been seeing that utilities, for the most part, if a customer is receiving a benefit such as LIHEAP, which stands for the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, it's a type of assistance that is available to customers to help with paying their utility bills. And if a customer is receiving that, the major utilities in the state are recognizing that that person cannot be disconnected from service. Unfortunately, we're not necessarily seeing that from the rural electric cooperatives. And we've had a problem that the municipal utilities are actually saying that they are exempt from this law. So customers of municipal electric utilities, such as we have in Farmington, Raton, and Las Cruces, may be especially at risk.
When they say that they think they're exempt from it, is the law not clear?
Actually, that is a problem, and it's something that we hope to clarify either during this legislative session or through an opinion from the Attorney General's office. Municipalities are exempt from regulation under the Public Utilities Act. There's something in the Public Utilities Act that says nothing in the Public Utilities Act applies to municipal utilities. But the winter moratorium law is not a part of the Public Utilities Act, and we believe that the legislature intended to protect all New Mexico utility customers, not just those who weren't not to provide an exception for those who are customers of municipalities.
We're talking to Jamie Porter Lara of Community Action New Mexico. So there is assistance available. Where does this assistance actually come from? Does it come from the utilities themselves?
There are some utilities that have fuel funds or some kind of assistance that is usually based on customer contributions, but that is very limited. So, for example, a customer receives utility service from PNM could go to the Salvation Army and apply for assistance through something called the Good Neighbor Fund. And that's where customers make contributions or they pay a little bit extra on their bills to help out other customers who are struggling. The trouble is that there's really not enough money available, although I do believe that right now there still are funds available from the Good Neighbor Fund. For the most part, though, customers who receive assistance in the state are receiving it from the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, which is both state and federally funded. And the way to get assistance through that program is to either contact the Human Services Department or to contact your utility, because they are actually required by law to provide information on how to apply for assistance.
So how many utilities are there providing power all over the state of New Mexico? It sounds like there's a lot and that they work in different ways.
Yes, there are some utilities that are regulated by the Public Regulation Commission, and they're called investor-owned utilities. And those utilities, like PNM, Southwest Public Service Company, El Paso Electric Company, and there are two other smaller utilities, I believe Raton Natural Gas and Zia Natural Gas, actually are fully regulated by the Public Regulation Commission and have their rates set by them. Then there's another tier of utilities, which are called rural electric co-ops. And the commission only in some cases would set the rates, or they provide limited regulation to the co-ops, but they do the consumer rules that are set by the commission do actually apply to the co-ops. And then there are smaller utilities that are actually owned by cities that are completely unregulated and are subject to the general laws of the state but are not regulated by the commission.
All rather confusing to the layman. Where does the PRC weigh in about this whole issue of people who can't afford to pay their bills?
Well, this is The PRC recognizes that this is a serious issue, and there are some ways in which they do have the jurisdiction to make policy or to make decisions that have a direct impact on this. One of the ways, of course, is that they set utility rates for the bigger investor-owned utilities in the state. And in setting rates, they actually have a direct impact on whether or not people can afford their bills because they are determining what people will actually pay. But there's another entire level at which they have an impact, which is that they set out what are the appropriate ways to treat customers of utilities. They essentially govern when a customer can be disconnected, when they can be assessed a deposit. They say what are the circumstances under which a utility is required to offer a customer a payment plan and what kinds of factors are to be considered. They're the ones who made the rules that said that if a customer has a low income and has a serious medical condition, that they can't be disconnected under any circumstances. There are many different ways in which they have an impact on that issue.
Now, what about the Attorney General's office? What is the involvement in this issue?
Well, the Attorney General is an advocate for consumers. And so if there are practices where utilities are essentially not are violating customer rights or not fully informing customers of their rights, this is an issue in which the Attorney General should be centrally involved. Unfortunately, these types of issues are concerns about the lack of notice to customers, violations of customer rights surrounding the winter shutoff moratorium is an issue that we've brought to the attention of the Attorney General over a year ago, and we just have received no response.
Is that right?
Yes. We have on numerous occasions, both formally and informally, been in touch with the Attorney General's office, and they've essentially been silent on this issue.
Well, I mean, when you have a law like this, one wonders, what are the provisions for its enforcement?
Well, that is a problem. We have this law, and we see that some people are able to obtain protection under it, but there are thousands of customers in this state who are clearly not being protected, but whom the legislature intended to protect. This is something that we are trying to obtain some clarification of through the PRC, and that has, but in some cases, that's been on a case-by-case basis. The Public Regulation Commission, which is the PRC, is also going to be doing a rulemaking on the winter shutoff moratorium law in an attempt to clarify some of these issues, particularly in regard to utilities' responsibilities and how they will implement the law in upcoming years. But it is largely incumbent upon the Public Regulation Commission and also upon the Attorney General, I think, to look for proactively determine that the winter shutoff moratorium is being abided by utilities, rather than to wait for violations or wait for a tragedy such as the one that happened in El Vado to start asking questions.
So, let's say that a utility, whether it be PNM or another utility, knows that a person has low income, has disabilities, they fail to pay their bill. Do they then get disconnect notices? Do they get a notice on their door? What happens? Or is there a mechanism by which that doesn't happen? Because I would think that the people who are most vulnerable in our society are the people who would be the most scared by getting a disconnect notice.
Absolutely. You raise an important issue, which is that utilities who should not be disconnecting customers from service because they are protected under the winter moratorium should not be sending threatening notices, making collection calls, or putting door hangers on the doors of people whom they know to be protected from disconnection during the winter. And this is actually a problem that we identified almost 2 years ago with Public Service Company of New Mexico, which is that we know that on more than 100,000 instances, they actually sent out disconnect notices that had incorrect information, and in many cases to customers whom they had no intention of disconnecting whatsoever. So, in effect, there were customers that they knew they could not disconnect, and they intended not to disconnect them, but they continued to send disconnect notices because they were hoping to collect more money from those customers during the winter months.
one hears these stories of people having to make a decision between paying their power bill and buying their groceries, or paying their power bill and buying their prescription medicines that are not covered by their insurance or Medicare or Medicaid. Do you hear these stories?
All the time. This is a reality, especially for the elderly people in New Mexico. Older folks have a very high level of commitment to paying all of their bills, and like most customers do. But they will stop eating, not buy medicine, live in one room of their house, not turn the heat high enough, forego medical care, lots of different things, just because their bills are unaffordable and it's so important to them to pay. They're also very afraid of losing utility service. It really is a necessity of life when it is as cold as it is outside. And so we do see that it is a serious problem, and that's why we think it's so important that customers know that they have a right to be free from disconnection during the winter months if they're facing those kinds of decisions between heating and eating or going to the doctor.
What happens when the winter is over? So let's say somebody, because of limited income and so on, gets behind by 1 or 2 or 3 months on their utility bills. Can they then just shut them off as soon as the weather gets warm?
Well, New Mexico has rules or laws that say that if a customer demonstrates the inability to pay a bill, they say that they can't afford to pay their utility bill off all at once, that the utility shall offer them a negotiated payment plan, and that payment plan shall be based on factors like what is that person's income, how many people live in the household, basically what are the circumstances, so that the payment plan can be set reasonably. So as you observed, somebody who coming out of winter, maybe 3 months behind, may have $800 or $1,000 that they may owe after the winter. And they have a right to negotiate with the utility a payment plan that is as long as they need, with payments that are appropriate size based on their ability to pay. It is unfortunately the case that most customers aren't being offered that option by utilities. And so what we're seeing more often is that a customer will call to make arrangements with the utility, and the utility will say to them, well, how quickly can you pay? We would like you to pay this off immediately. And this is once again an instance in which customers are not understanding that they actually have the right to extend repayment of that debt over multiple months.
And of course, it's in the financial interest of the power company to collect as much as fast as possible. So it's a real conflict between, you know, the profits of a company and the needs of the most vulnerable people.
That's true. What's also interesting, though, is that we know that a utility company actually has a better chance of collecting more from a customer that they work with than they do with a customer that they just disconnect or try to force into a payment arrangement that is unreasonable, because that puts customers into untenable situations. They may lose service and not be able to reconnect it for a long time. And ultimately, the debts of those customers become debts that all ratepayers pay for, because the utility just expenses it to us as bad debt. So interestingly, in most cases, it's not the utility that's on the hook for that. It's the ratepayers that are on the hook. And it's better for all of us if they actually work with the customer to pay more.
Tell us a little bit before we go about Community Action New Mexico.
Community Action New Mexico is the Association of Community Action Agencies in New Mexico, but it's also part of a broader national network. Back in the war on poverty, something called the Community Services Block Grant was created and disseminated to states with the mission of ending poverty. So all the states in the nation have money from the federal government that is intended to work at the community level on ending poverty. And so there are 8 community action agencies in the state that have a variety of programs and policy objectives that are all corresponding to ending poverty. So, for example, there may be food pantries, adult daycare, Head Start programs, financial literacy counseling, tax help preparation, those kinds of things, all geared toward how do we get families, how do we give them a leg up into the middle class. To Community Action New Mexico works at the policy level on these kinds of issues. Rather than providing direct services, we try to find the policy arenas in New Mexico in which we can have a big impact on things like affordability of energy costs or even the availability of mainstream financial services to low-income customers. So, for example, another thing that Community Action does is work on match savings accounts that are intended to build assets in our communities, and also providing financial literacy counseling and help with tax preparation, those kinds of things.
So people can find out more about all of this at communityactionnewmexico.org. Anything to watch for during the upcoming legislative session?
Yes, there are a couple of things that are going on. One is that we are hoping that the legislature is going to give the PRC, the Public Regulation Commission, the authority to gear energy efficiency programs specifically to low-income customers. What we believe that a long-term solution to the problem of energy affordability actually is not strictly through subsidies, which are really an emergency response, but rather to addressing the serious problem of energy efficiency of households and particularly low-income homes.
People who are the least likely to have expensive windows or solar panels and so on.
Exactly. How do we get to, you know, the 30 or 40% of the state who, without special programs that are really enabling them to be part of the solution to climate change, how are we going to get energy efficiency to those folks?
Anything you want to add?
Yes, it's really important that people know that there is somewhere to go if they are having trouble affording their utility bills, negotiating with the utility, or obtaining protection under the winter shutoff moratorium this year, and that's the Public Regulation Commission. They can be called. They are charged, actually, with helping consumers on a case-by-case basis to ensure that they are able to obtain their rights under New Mexico laws. So call your commissioner or call the PRC.
What's the telephone number of the PRC that people can call?
Consumers can call 1-888-4-ASK-PRC. And that number
The digit 4 and then ask PRC. What is that in numbers?
In numbers, it's 1-888-427-5772. And that's the number that consumers can call even if they don't know who their public regulation commissioner is. But I want to emphasize it's really important if people are having any problems with the issues that we've been discussing today, that their commissioner does want to hear from them.
And that's a toll-free number. Jamie Porter Lara, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And once again, Community Action New Mexico is on the web at communityactionnewmexico.org. We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome by telephone Wendy Kiefover-Ring. She's with Sinopu, a Colorado-based environmental organization. Welcome to KSFR.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Now, we are here to talk about something that is happening today, which I suspect most of our listeners have no idea about, and that is that the United States Environmental Protection Agency is calling for public comment on the banning of two poisons that are used to kill wild animals, wild mammals. What is going on? What are these poisons, and how are they currently being used?
Right. Let me just give you a little background information. There is another government agency called the USDA Wildlife Services. It's different than the Fish and Wildlife Service. This is an agency that's been around for 100 years, and they engage war on wildlife, eradicating predators and other wildlife, especially for agricultural interests. And they have been killing animals, particularly using poisons, chemical warfare, for over 100 years. And we are asking EPA to ban two of the most important predator poisons that they use, compound 1080 and sodium cyanide.
So why are they being used? In other words, what is in the interest of the citizens of the United States that their government agencies are poisoning mammals in the wild?
It's mostly for livestock growers, and for the predator poisons, it's mostly livestock growers, so sheep and cattle ranchers, especially on western public lands. And so they put out these things called M44s, which contain a smelly bait lure, and it has a little pellet of sodium cyanide, and the lure attracts a canid species. Particularly coyotes, which is what they're aiming for, and the animal bites on that, tugs on that bait, and a spring-loaded device shoots this pellet of sodium cyanide into the mouth of the animal, and once it contacts moisture, it turns to cyanide gas, and it asphyxiates the victim within 1 to 2 minutes. The problem with these M44 devices is they're highly indiscriminate. And so lots of unintended animals get killed by them, including endangered species such as wolves, California condors, and grizzly bears. And, you know, they kill a lot of domestic animals like dogs. You know, there's been two cases in Utah where people were out on federal public lands with their dogs recreating, and the dogs got into those. And one guy, you know, he was out rabbit hunting. He was on a public road. His dog got into it. The dog died, and he was literally holding his dog in his arms when it expired. And he carried the dog for 2 miles back to his truck, and from that experience, he was secondarily exposed to cyanide gas.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's really awful. And so we are hoping that the EPA will take a look at a petition that Sinopiu and several other groups sent to them asking them to ban, you know, sodium cyanide. And the other poison that we're working on banning is a thing called compound 1080. And this poison is so toxic that practically about a teaspoon of this material can kill between 2 and 6 people. It was initially banned in 1972 under the Nixon administration, but the livestock growers howled loudly, and Ronald Reagan brought it back in 1985. In the limited form of livestock protection collars, and what these are a collar that you strap onto the head of a sheep or goat, and it contains these rubber bladders of poison. And the idea is the coyote or whatever will bite that sheep's neck and then puncture that bladder and get the poison in their mouth and die. But the problem is this stuff is, you know, it's very toxic. It's a Category 1 poison, the most poisonous pesticide that EPA regulates, you know, in that category. Category 1 means, you know, of the highest degree of acute toxicity. And death is excruciating. It can take between 2 to 15 hours. This pesticide is only registered in 11 states, but there's lots of problems with spillage, contamination, lost collars. And, you know, both of these chemicals are bioterrorism weapons.
So these chemicals are bioterrorism weapons, meaning that they need to be carefully guarded or somebody can make off with them, or what's...
Exactly right. And the agency charged with managing and holding these weapons are, you know, the USDA Wildlife Services, and they have been in trouble by the Office of Inspector General for not being accountable for how they maintain their supplies of these toxic weapons. And you know, they've lost, you know, in one instance they lost 2,000 capsules of sodium cyanide. They had these poisons out in a way that people could steal it, and people had unauthorized access to it. And so they were audited in 2005 and 2006, and then in 2007 Wildlife Services put out this astonishing newsletter saying that, you know, they are having all kinds of accidents and problems with their agency, and one of the things they admitted having problems with is hazardous chemicals. And so we are very concerned about, you know, in the, you know, post 9/11 era that this agency is holding these chemicals and is completely unaccountable. And we liken Wildlife Services to Blackwater. They're very obstructionist. They're unaccountable to the public. They're rogue. They're opaque. I mean, essentially what they do is they kill, in 2006, they killed 1.6 million animals. Of that, about 13,900 were killed by sodium cyanide in 2006. So just a huge amount of death from this agency. And most people don't even know this goes on. And it's funded with taxpayer dollars.
How much money are we paying to put these poisons into our wildlife?
Yeah, their total budget is $100 million annually. Some of that money is from cooperator funds, which means the wool growers and the cattlemen put money towards that. But a good half of that is taxpayer money.
We're talking to Wendy Kiefover-Ring from CNAPU, which is a Colorado-based environmental organization. So this, for example, compound 1080, the one where one teaspoon is highly lethal to anybody who comes near it, when that goes into the environment through a predator taking the bait, eating the bait animal, so to speak, and then getting poisoned, does some of it go into the, I mean, it sounds a little scary, like, what is it, does it go into the ground? Does it go into the streams?
Right.
I mean, does it go into us?
Yeah, it can go into soils, and it can go into water, and that's some of the concern. If it's very cold out, for example, it takes a long time for this stuff to break down. And the disposal of this stuff is really a problem. People that use compound 1080 are supposed to, you know, once they get these collars and they're, you know, they've been punctured or if they're not going to use them, they're supposed to either burn them or bury them under 3 feet of soil, and it has to be so many feet away from groundwater. I mean, contamination is a huge problem, and often these collars go missing. We looked at a bunch of records that came from Wildlife Services in their Texas program, and huge numbers of these collars went missing, and the animals that killed the sheep went missing, the coyotes went missing, some of the sheep went missing. It's so irresponsible to even be using this kind of stuff when there's lots of non-lethal alternatives to protecting livestock, such as using guard animals or using pens or sheds or a whole host of things that livestock growers can use that are not toxic and not lethal. And it will actually work better in the long term because coyotes are absolutely resilient in the face of persecution. We've been trying to kill coyotes for 100 years, and the result has been they've increased their range threefold. And the reason is they're so highly adaptable. If you start killing coyotes, they change their breeding strategies. You actually end up with more females breeding. If you leave a pack of coyotes intact, the alpha pair act as a birth control mechanism over the whole pack. But if the alpha pair are removed, then every female in the pack is now available for breeding. And when the alpha pair are there, they behaviorally suppress breeding of all the other females in the pack.
Let me ask you this. I mean, we've on this program talked quite a bit about grazing on public lands and, you know, the benefits to the people who are doing the grazing, but also the detriments to the environment and so on. This is one that I didn't know about. How much of a problem is predation, our predators, on these livestock that are grazing on public lands?
Well, I can tell you nationally what the numbers are. I can't tell you just public lands because I don't have access to that information, but nationwide in 2005, of the total number of cattle produced, it was 104.5 million cattle. Of that, 0.18% were killed by predators, whereas something like 4 to 5% of cattle died unintentionally from birthing problems or, you know, being struck by lightning or cattle rustling or a whole host of things. So the predation issue is just minuscule when you look at the data, you know, across the board. For sheep ranchers, they have more problems with predators. Of the total sheep produced in 2004, 3% were killed by predators. So still, it's nothing compared to other unintended consequences such as birthing and weather and literally sheep falling on their back and not able to get up, they die. So we're throwing an arsenal of weaponry at predators on public and private lands across the West, and a lot of it includes these very toxic poisons, and we're hoping that EPA will rule on our petition and ban compound 1080 and sodium cyanide.
Are public comments still being taken on this issue?
Yes, until January 15th. And if people will go to our website, you can learn more and there's, you know, the information about how to submit a letter, and that's sinapu.org, and that's spelled sinapu.org.
Tell us more about Sinapu.
Sure. We've been around since 1991, and we do advocacy for wild carnivores, so wolves, black bears, lynx, coyotes, and the like.
And to what extent are these various animals truly endangered? What are their numbers looking like in the time that you've been doing this work?
Well, for wolves, they are not recovered, you know, across most of their range, and we don't have them in the southern Rocky Mountain region, which is mostly Colorado, for example. Coyotes are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. They're across the whole nation. Black bears, they're patchily dispersed depending on how much, you know, tree cover there is for them. So it just depends on the species. We've got, you know, kit foxes and swift foxes. There's almost none left. To, you know, other species like raccoons, where they're ubiquitous.
Which are the animals most likely to be killed in order to save livestock?
Coyotes are the primary target of wildlife services. So they kill about 80,000 coyotes a year.
And so what you're saying is it's not that coyotes are endangered, but that it's an ineffective, poisoning them is not only bad for the ecosystem, but an ineffective strategy for getting rid of coyotes.
Exactly right. And not only do they poison them, but they trap them, they shoot them from aircraft, and they do all kinds of heinous things, you know, kill them with neck snares and things like that. In fact, in the January issue of Men's Journal, there's a nice expose story about wildlife services. And the very front picture is a Wildlife Services agent in his khaki uniform with his American flag patch holding a coyote carcass that's been strangled by a neck snare. And so this is what goes on, this war against wildlife and paid for by the public, and yet very few public even know this is happening.
When you talked about a better strategy for guarding livestock, you talked about guard animals. What are you talking about?
There's a variety of animals. Surprisingly, even mixing cattle with sheep is a very good deterrent for coyotes and other predators.
Why is that?
Just because cattle are fairly aggressive. Sheep are completely docile and have very poor predator avoidance strategies, and therefore not able to save themselves because they've been bred to be tractable over thousands of years.
Wait, but a cow will defend itself against a coyote?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, there's Lassiter Grasslands beef here in Colorado. If a cow loses her calf to a predator, they send the mother to slaughter because they think that she's not a fit mother. And so what they're trying to do is, you know, use natural selection to make the herd, you know, even stronger against predators. There's other guard animals like llamas, guard dogs. There's a variety of guard dogs, you know, Great Pyrenees, Karelians, and other animals like that. Using herders to protect, you know, sheep and out on public lands is another method. The most important thing really is to bring cattle and sheep near people and put them in barns or in sheds. When they're lambing or calving, because that's the time when they're the most vulnerable to predation. And then another strategy is picking up carcasses. There's a lot of mortality during the lambing and calving season. And using, you know, fences, electronic calls, and all sorts of things to deter predators, which is a lot more cost-effective in the long run than this, you know, never-ending cycle of killing.
Have you been able to reach the ranching community, the livestock growing community, with your reasoning?
Absolutely no. I mean, it's very, you know, it's almost like a religion to them to hate predators. And in fact, on the Federal Register website, where our petition is, some of the comment letters from the ranching community are just absolutely vitriolic. It's just amazing to me. But that said, there's a couple ranchers up there saying, yeah, we don't need these poisons. In fact, you know, we do use these non-lethal alternatives and they work. So, you know, it's not a universal reaction.
Well, Wendy Kivover-Ring, I want to thank you very much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, thank you for the opportunity.
And once again, the website is
SINAPU.org, S-I-N-A-P-U.org.
And what does SINAPU mean?
It's the U Indian word for wolves.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you once again.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Kenneth Knight is joining us, and we're going to hear some music and then be talking to Kenneth Knight.
Come and let our swelling song mount like the whirling wind. As it meets our singing throng, so blithe of heart and mind. Care and sorrow now be gone. Brothers in song, sing on.
And we're joined by Brother Ken Knight, musical director of the Zia Singers and the Men's Camerata, both of whom have concerts coming up. Christmas is over, but you're still singing.
That's right. I make a special point of trying to avoid the holiday season with my concertizing. I think the public just gets saturated with holiday concerts. And there's always a bit of a lull beginning of January, so we like to think that we jump into the fray.
There is a lull in the beginning of January. I was looking at the website for all the tickets for all the events that are happening. There's nothing happening at all, practically.
Yes. Clever strategy, don't you think?
Yeah. So you have the Zia Singers, which is an all-women's group, whom we're going to hear in a moment, are singing on Saturday and Sunday, January 19th and 20th.
Uh-huh. At the Loretto Chapel.
At the Loretto Chapel. And the... This coming weekend, the Men's Camerata on January 12th and 13th is also at the Loretto Chapel.
Correct, yeah.
So what are the kind of programs that you're singing?
Mixed, very, very mixed programs.
As always.
I always love to end my concerts with a group of spirituals because I think they're great music and there are lots and lots of arrangers who've done wonderful and creative arrangements of the spirituals. But the men's program this coming weekend also includes a couple of lighthearted folk songs, The Drummer and the Cook. It's an English sea chanty arranged by Robert Shaw and Alice Parker. A Pennsylvania Dutch folk song, Dr. Eisenbart.
What's that about?
It's about a doctor who will cure all of your ills.
Ah, mm-hmm. Perfect for Santa Fe.
Exactly. What else? We're doing a group of contemporary pieces by people you've probably never heard of, but they're wonderful composers. David Childs, these are all living composers. David Childs, Patty Drennan, David Dickow. Beautiful settings of texts by Christina Rossetti and others. We actually begin the program with a sort of a classical group, the song you just heard by Edvard Grieg. Then we do two settings of the famous Ave Maria text.
Are songs like the Grieg, for example, translated into lots of different languages? I mean, did you do the translation into English?
No, luckily someone else had already done it. It's originally in Norwegian, but we do it in English. And then we're doing the two settings of the Ave Maria with a Gregorian chant and then a motet by Victoria, which is based on the chant tune.
What is it about Ave Maria? It is a piece that's universally loved.
I know.
I'm not sure you could find a person on planet Earth who doesn't love that piece.
There are hundreds of different musical settings of it, almost all of them famous. You know, it's one of Schubert's most famous pieces. Gounod did a tune that he set to a Bach prelude. It's always sung at weddings. There's a wonderful composer, just died a few years ago, Franz Biebel, whose most famous choral piece is Ave Maria. Just lots and lots of settings of it. I don't know why it's so popular, but it is. Never doing a seldom heard chorus from a seldom heard oratorio by Beethoven, Christ on the Mount of Olives.
Never heard of it.
It's pretty obscure.
Why are some pieces by Beethoven, for example, obscure and some of them so well known? I mean, is it, you know, Beethoven's a great composer, but is it just not as good as his other stuff?
Well, that's true of every composer. You can find pieces in every composer's output that are undeservedly neglected.
Uh-huh. So this is undeservedly. I was asking if it was deservedly neglected.
No,
of course,
no.
You're not going to say so on the air.
This is a charming and wonderful piece. It's actually a little scene. A group of centurions, soldiers, are out searching for Jesus to arrest him. And they're sort of skulking around, trying to find him in the Garden of, on the Mount of Olives, in the Garden of Gethsemane. Then we're doing a setting. One of those wonderful Russian liturgical pieces. This one is by Gretchaninov. The original Russian was the setting of a familiar text, Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace. My men's chorus really doesn't seem to like singing in Russian. It's just extremely difficult for them.
Russian choral singing also is a different technique of singing, isn't it?
It is. Well, it is and it isn't. Russian choruses are especially known for their phenomenal low basses, the basses that can just sing almost sub-audible
can
pitches.
Vibrate the roof tiles.
Yeah. The liturgical music from Russia is fantastic and very rich. And anyway, we're doing one of those, and then we're doing a youthful piece by Giacomo Puccini before he became famous as an opera composer. I didn't realize this. He was from a long line of composers. His father, grandfather, great-grandfather were all composers. When he was a young man, he was asked by the music director of a church that he attended sometimes when it was in an adjoining city gambling. If he would write a setting for Easter, for the text about the royal banners go forth. And so this is a piece by Puccini. But it's quite a mixed bag.
Now let's hear just maybe a minute or so of some music from the Zia Singers,
right,
and then we'll come back. So a musical sneeze.
Never heard it before, have you?
No.
That's a piece from the musical Grease. It's called It's Raining on Prom Night. My hair is a mess.
Ah, and so the Zia Singers, do you overlap music from the Zia Singers and the Men's Camerata? Do you do any of the same songs?
Occasionally we do. They're completely different arrangements, of course, but I've done many of the same spirituals.
And so the Zia Singers, do you also add end those concerts with the spirituals?
Almost always, yeah. Mm-hmm. The Zias have a tradition of of doing lighter, mostly pop music on their spring concerts. This winter concert will be somewhat more serious in nature, but yes, we are ending with three spirituals on the Zia Singers concert also.
And also, classical music and things along the lines
classical
of
music.
Folk music.
Yes, and we're, in fact, we're doing a setting of four pieces by a local Santa Fe composer, Conrad DeYoung, who is retired here. He was a professor of composition in, at one of the campuses on the University of Wisconsin.
Well, Kenneth Knight, it's always wonderful to have you here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe and the Midwinter Musicale, how do you say it?
Musicale, yes.
Musicale is at the Loreto Chapel on January 12th and 13th at the Loreto Chapel. What time is that at?
It's Saturday the 12th, it's at 8 o'clock, and Sunday the 13th at 6 o'clock.
And then the same thing the following weekend, no, Saturday, January 19th at 8 o'clock, and Sunday, January 20th at 7, also at the Loreto Chapel right here in Santa Fe. And for more information, you can call?
You can call me, 466-3637.
Kenneth Knight is the musical director of many choruses, including the Zia Singers and the Men's Camerata. Great to have you here.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and I'm glad to say that we've been getting feedback from the website saying, yeah, I can't listen to your show in the morning, but I'm able to listen to it at other times, so we're very happy about that. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.